I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello again. Thanks for joining us. Claire, how are you doing?
Yeah, all good. I hope you've noticed after the last dig about my 50 Shades of Grey, there's a bit of a change.
There's a whacking great picture that seems to have kind of landed in your very tasteful kitchen. And yeah, it's lovely. It's full of colour, isn't it? Absolutely bursting.
It is. And with my colourful flowers, I hope you're appreciating that
I'm
moving away.
It's no longer the grey house, no.
There's no shades of grey here. Well, there are, but, you know, highlighted with a few colourful bits of magic.
Absolutely.
So what's been going on this week? I know you've had a birthday.
Yeah, I have. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah.
What did you do?
I went to see the Damien Hirst exhibition at Houghton Hall. It was
very cultured birthday.
Yeah, I know. Well, I got a bit drunk as well, yeah. It was brilliant. I loved it. I don't know if it's your kind of thing, you know.
Oh, yeah, I love a bit of Damien.
Yeah, well, I know some people have got very mixed feelings about him, but, you know, they had these great sort of bigger pieces out in the grounds, which were amazing. And then inside the house, there were, you know, spots and spots kind of as far as the eye could see. And what was, you know, you go into a gallery and it's all kind of white space, and actually at Houghton you went in and they had spots set against kind of flock wallpaper and trompe l'oeil and gilding, so it was a bit of a sensory overload, very different from your nice soothing grey house.
Yeah, it was funny you're talking about spots, because it's been a bit of a spotty week for me as well, but not the walls covered in spots, but my daughter's skin.
Oh my God.
Chicken pox.
A complete bugger. But, you know, good to get it over with early. And how's she doing?
Yeah, she's pretty much back on form, although throwing out a few tantrums at the same time.
Nice.
Do you think this is like what people want to listen to?
I don't know. Is that why people have tuned in, all of this biddy banter? I don't know.
Middle-aged women banter. Yeah, so on that note, I would like to know what people are thinking about this new format. We'd love to know, like, so please get in touch and let rip with the good, the bad, the ugly. So moving on, Susie, tell us about this week's backstory.
Okay, so this week we're hearing from Dave Chawner. He's brilliant. He's really, really funny, but he's talking about something really serious, which is his experience of having anorexia. I really like the way he speaks about it, because basically he doesn't dodge the hard stuff. He's, you know, kind of brutally honest in places, but he also made me laugh. So here's Dave. Hello, Dave, and thank you very much for inviting me to your lovely studio.
Thank you very much. Cheers for coming all this way.
I know. I've just seen a proper argument out on...
Have you?
Yeah, there was a crash and it was... Anyway.
Oh, no.
I digress.
I thought you meant in the building. I was going to say, wow, that is unusual around here.
Different story altogether. So thank you for having me here, and welcome to the Backstory Podcast with Claire and Susie. So the idea of the backstory is that we've all got one. We've all had things going on in our lives that maybe make us who we are. And what we ask people to do is to cast their mind back over the course of their life and think about the ups and the downs, the peaks and the troughs, and all the bits in between, and maybe choose an experience of some sort or an event to tell us about.
I suppose the backstory that makes me relevant for this is the anorexia.
this is something that started when you were...
So I was like 17, and yeah. For me, like, it kind of... to be honest, it was like, yeah, it was just something that kind of insidiously came into my own sort of routine, and it became like an addiction, an obsession. It became something that I enjoyed. I didn't see that like it was a problem. For me, I wanted to hold that moment as it was and kind of like crystallize it in amber, and just didn't want it to ever change. And this is something we see like with a lot of restrictive eating disorders, that it's a sort of a way to stop growing up. And I think that's definitely something that resonates with me, because I just wanted to stay as it was.
That's something I've never heard of before, and that really surprises me. So wanting to kind of stay in adolescence and not progress into adulthood, you mean?
Yeah, I think unpacking that a little bit, that's obviously diverse in sort of many different ways. I think for me, there were little things like, for example, my sex drive. I didn't like that all of my friends were becoming sexually active, and I was kind of getting left behind in that. I didn't want to move on and go to university. I didn't want to leave the place where I was, and it kind of all felt a bit out of, and I don't want to use the word control, because I think to use a one-word simplification of a very complex neurological disease seems a bit, you know, seems a bit wrong. But I think it was a kind of like, as remiss as I am to say, it was a kind of control.
Okay, so you say that it started kind of insidiously. So was there a point at which you clocked that something was going on? When did you start to realise that there was a thing here?
I remember there was like... I remember very specifically one day, like, after breakfast, I nipped upstairs to like weigh myself again. I remember my mom like crying and screaming from the bottom of the stairs, like, "You're anorexic." Which was like, to be honest, like, that didn't really fit the model for what I was experiencing. What I experienced was that I loved it, and it was great. And like, actually, if mom was gonna react like that, then that was her own stuff. It wasn't mine. I was enjoying what I was doing. And it was odd, because like at that point in time, I was talking to my friends at school, and like, they were going like, "Mate, you haven't eaten anything at lunch for days." And I was like, "Yeah, just anorexic, innit?" And I just kind of hid in plain sight. So it was something that I slowly came to realise was a problem, but the problem for me really centred around realising it, because it was always BBC Panorama or Dispatches or something like that, and that seemed so melodramatic for what I was experiencing. What I was experiencing was incredibly mundane.
But also, you say that you loved it, so presumably BBC Panorama and whatever was portraying it as this horrific thing that was ruining young people's lives, but actually you were loving it. And I think that's what's so interesting about so many kind of conditions and ways of working, where people are looking in and thinking, you know, what the hell's going on? And actually, for the person, they must be getting something out of it. There must be a payback, because that's why you're doing it. So the payback for you was to do with your sex drive, and to do with kind of feeling, you know, that it was stopping you from sort of maturing more and sort of turning more into a man, perhaps kind of helping you to stay in that moment,
among other things. I mean, there's so many things. I kind of see it now when I'm coming out of the loop, and without being triggering, I do wonder, like, how do people get by that aren't anorexic? You know what I mean? Because for me, it was reducing my sex drive, but also numbing my anxiety, numbing unwanted emotion. When you don't feed the brain, doesn't have enough chemicals to kind of like secrete a lot of the things, so it starts to shut down.
Of course.
So for me, it was a way
it's like a sedative almost.
Absolutely, in the same way that booze or any other substance abuse
that's
is.
So interesting.
So I'm like, for me, when people are like, "Oh, you're anorexic," I was like, "How are you not?" You know what I mean? So I think there was stuff like that going on. I think as well, always difficult to try and uncouple anorexia, which is an eating disorder, with stuff like body dysmorphia, which is to, you know, it wasn't about vanity, but for me, it was actually more about fitting in rather than standing out. And I remember horribly, even though I love my school, there was one guy who was of a larger frame, and people kind of slapping his belly and saying whale time. And I remember thinking at a very early stage of like, if you want to fit in, you can't stand out, so you just have to lose weight in order to be like everyone else.
Okay.
So it wasn't about like trying to look good or trying to get a lady for the prom. It was more about, I don't want to be different. I want to sort of But it fits so many things. I mean, the buzz of it as well. When you were like restricting and you felt like you could restrict for long times, that was absolutely great. And standing on the scales and seeing the numbers drop was amazing. And also that it dealt in numbers as well. Mm. I was doing my exams, I was doing coursework deadlines. And actually to feel like a success in life is really hard. And, you know, different people were getting into Oxford, Cambridge, Durham, whatever. And I wasn't. I was like, oh, am I a complete failure? So, yeah, numbers were something that didn't lie.
Because it's something that's, well, I mean, stating the obvious, it's something that's quantifiable, but it's also something that is completely within your control.
Yeah, big time.
So can you kind of describe some of the behaviours that would play into those numbers? Mm. You mentioned about weighing yourself, and would you kind of record what you'd eaten? Would you...
I found it hard to forget. So I mean, like, looking at some of the behaviors, for example, weighing, like whenever I woke up, the first thing I'd do is I'd go to the toilet and hop on the scales because I want it to be as empty as possible. And then no matter whether the number was good or bad or even indifferent, I would then move the scales and get another reading and another reading. And I'd normally weigh myself like 4 or 5 times. And then I'd go downstairs, and if I couldn't avoid it, if I was like really famished and whatever, I would have a low calorie breakfast. And I'm not going to tell people what that is. I don't want to tip you. And then I weigh myself again, and then I would kind of go about my business, and I'd weigh myself 2-3 times sort of during the day. I was popping home from school to weigh myself. I was popping home at lunch, and then when I'd eaten stuff, I'd weigh myself. Those kind of behaviours. But again, with the calories, I remember, I used to know what food was in every calories. And that makes recovery hard because I can't unknow that. Mm. But I would inflate the calories just to give myself a nice buffer. So, for example, guidelines, apple, 40 to 60 calories. Now, I used to see that as about 100 calories.
Okay.
And I don't like talking in calories because I don't want to trigger anyone. But that's just one example. So I'd always add sort of 50%. So I knew what I would allow myself each day. And I would, in conversations and in the playground and on the way to school, I'd constantly be totting up like, oh, I've had that and that and that. And then it kind of got pathological. Like I'd be like, oh, there was a dash of milk in my coffee. That should be X, but I'm gonna make it Y. Those are the kind of behaviors that I think were going on in the background.
And one of the reasons that we really wanted to talk with you was because, you know, obviously the kind of stereotypical idea of eating disorders is, you know, teenage girls and so on. And I wonder what the particular differences are for guys. You know, one of the things that I had wondered was whether there was pressure on boys to kind of bulk up and, you know, to take kind of steroids or whatever to get that bulked up image. So I just I'm just trying to kind of get my head around what it was like as a young guy in that situation.
I think you'd have to ask one, because what I mean by that is one of my defining features has never been my gender. I have a very laissez-faire relationship with my masculinity. And I think from a very early age, I kind of was like, I'm not really a bloke. And I don't identify as a woman in any way, shape or form. And I don't mean to be transphobic, but it wasn't, if someone said, explain yourself to me, I would be like, oh, I'm a 17 year old. I wouldn't be like, I'm a man.
Okay.
So I suppose like I'm perhaps more in risk of eating disorders. Maybe this is something we need to talk about more, but I don't really feel a strong link to my masculinity or any real gender. It's never been my defining feature.
So those kind of gender stereotypical roles didn't maybe have the hold on you that they might have done with other people. There was a really interesting article that I read recently about a guy who had binge eating disorder, and then he would go to the gym and work out, you know, compulsively to kind of work off the calories, but also to, you know, to kind of build himself up. And I found that really interesting, just that kind of what I think what he said about it was that actually it was almost quite easy to hide because it was behavior, this kind of being seen as a big eater and then being seen as somebody that goes and works out really hard at the gym was seen as quite kind of healthy, normal, blokey behaviour. So he went under the radar for a long time.
Yeah.
you said that your mum used the word anorexia and you had friends using that word. So you were getting a lot out of it, but at what stage did, I'm guessing here because you know, you sought help, at what stage did that balance start to tip? At what stage did you stop getting enough out of it to feel that you wanted to change behaviours?
I think for me that was a weird one because I remember it very specifically. It was the summer of 2008 and one of my mates called me, and at that point in time I was 19, and he said, it was over the summer holiday in university, very good friend of mine, and he said, look, there's this thing called TEFL teaching, which we're teaching English and a foreign language. We've got, like, I'm doing it, there's one of the places available, do you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, cracking, great stuff. So I went down there, and I remember I arrived and we were living in this camp in the middle of Somerset, and it was 3.5 miles to the nearest shop, and then it only sort of, the only thing that the shop really stocked was toilet paper and a general sense of malaise. And I remember coming, and we had food morning, noon and night. There was nothing else on campus.
Right.
There was no calories on any of the food, and there were no healthy options. It was just pizza, pasta, chips.
Oh, God.
And the food got to everyone, and it was a common sticking point to hear people. So it was, oh, yeah, Jerry's, you know, cooked this again. But for me, it kind of, I realised.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Something wasn't right when I started getting nightmares about the cookies, when I started setting my alarm in the middle of the night to try and do exercise, when I couldn't actually talk to people because I was constantly trying to tot up the calories. And then what happens with anorexia commonly that isn't talked about is when you restrict for a long time, what can be typical is a binge comes along as well.
Right.
And then when my binges came, it was very public because we all ate together. And I remember that summer very specifically, although it was 4 weeks, it just had this huge effect on me of, like, I just remember thinking, like, wow, this isn't normal, this isn't okay. And that was when I was 19, but it took me until I was 24 in order to feel comfortable enough to actually get help for it.
And what nature did that help take?
Well, I think, like, because I kind of accepted that I was anorexic. And I remember even saying it before then, but it was in a kind of jokey way of, like, you know, what are you, Capricorn? What am I? Oh, anorexic, you know? And I think, like, humour has always kind of been my foil. But I think that's why I want to use humour in a more healthy way now. Because, like, I know that, like, even when I came back and I was like, yeah, you know what? Like, I have traits of anorexia. I was like, no doctor's going to see me. Some white middle-class bloke going, oh, it's really terrible. And, like, oh, yeah, you are struggling nearly as much as those African toddlers, you know what I mean? And it felt self-indulgent, it felt wrong, and I kind of felt guilty about that because I was like, you know what, I'm living a great life. The only reason I got help, I was very, by the time I got to 24, I was very openly relapsing, and for me, I was very open that it was a slow suicide attempt, and I'd started writing the letters, I'd started, like, planning the films for, like, my niece when she got to her 16th and 18th birthday, and I'd looked into how anorexia normally takes people, of which I'm not going to go into that, but I'd started to try and speed up that process. And the only reason I got help was I just stopped feeling anything. And I stopped getting enjoyment out of anything. I started pushing people away. I felt constantly lonely. I couldn't hold on to thoughts. I didn't have any concentration, any attention span. And I remember specifically there was one week where I'd done this big piece for the BBC, which was lovely. And then I hosted a night at the Comedy Store, which was always going to be my dream. And then the day after, I was one of the stand-ins for Mock the Week for the first ever time. And I remember everything in my career just seemed great. And I just remember feeling absolutely nothing. And I went to the GP the next day and I said, look, I'm not feeling anything. And they put me onto antidepressants and referred me down the channels. And I was very staunch that I wanted to be treated for depression, not anorexia. And I refused treatment for the anorexia four times. And it was only when someone at Lambeth Talking Therapies got very hardline with me and she said, look, we can treat the depression without the anorexia, but it's going to do sod all. If you don't charge your laptop, you wouldn't expect it to work. It's exactly the same with your brain. So you've got a choice. You can either put up with this or you can make a change. And that was the only time that I'd actually thought, oh, maybe there is another option. And actually that was the first time in a strange way, and I don't know if other people feel like this, but I was like, wow, I'm not going to die. And as ungrateful and horrible as it sounds, that was an overwhelmingly scary feeling. That was an overwhelmingly... almost, I don't want to use the word depressing, but sad feeling in itself.
Because you'd been heading down that path. Yeah. You thought that that was where you were going to go. Yeah. And suddenly you've got to choose something else. Yeah. And you've got a whole stretch of something in front of you.
It's like, it felt like being in a meeting and you've got the meeting notes in front of you and you're like, brilliant. We're on the final second bullet point. Brilliant. And then someone pulls out another page and goes, right, we're on to page two now. You're like, oh God. That was in itself, strangely, the thought of life terrified me so much more than the thought of death.
One of the things that I hadn't realised until fairly recently was how high the mortality rate is for people with anorexia. And I don't know about the other eating disorders. I don't know about the different levels of mortality. But, you know, when you say about feeling kind of self-indulgent and so on, actually, it is an absolute killer, isn't it?
It's anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any mental health problem. And it kind of makes that thing almost worse because, yes, it does feel selfish. And, yes, other people can feel so helpless, and I think the ripple effect of eating disorders in general is so much bigger than we realise.
So what helped when you decided that you were kind of, to coin a phrase, choosing life?
Never had it like that before. I think firstly, choosing, right? Like, firstly, no one made me do it, so it's my own choice. Yeah. Great. Secondly, as well, it was positively spun, because I really hate it when people say, oh, okay, we're going to get rid of the anorexia. Because the way that I heard that is the same way that an alcoholic would say, right, we're going to get rid of the booze.
Taking something off you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think what really helped me is to realise that you stand to gain stuff rather than focusing around what you lose.
You start to get stuff back in your life.
Big time.
Yeah. Thank you so much telling us all about that, Dave. That's brilliant. It's really lovely to meet you. So, Claire, you know, there's so much in there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm actually really pleased we talked to a guy about anorexia because straight off the bat, it challenges some of the stereotypes, doesn't it?
Definitely.
We have it that it's like all teenage girls, really, but clearly not. I know you were quite keen to talk to a man, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you said like 11% of those affected by an eating disorder are male, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a nice statistic, you know, National Institute's.
Not a nice one.
Not a nice statistic, but from the National Institute, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like there's so much to understand here, and I'd quite like to come back to this subject because I don't think I've really got my head around it yet. And I guess, you know, everyone's experience is different, but I did think it would be good to talk to a guy. I watched the Louis Theroux programme about eating disorders, which was on ages ago, and he spoke to quite a few older people as well, which I thought was really interesting. So, you know, we're sort of starting to hear these different perspectives.
Yeah, I think that programme will always stay with me, actually, and the woman taking the sweet that she had sucked on a little bit and then sucking on it a little bit more and then putting it back in the cupboard. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, let's be clear. You know, I didn't know this until recently, but this is a really serious illness. It's got the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder. It wasn't in the podcast, but Dave did talk about a young woman that he knew that had died recently. And, you know, it just kind of really brings home how serious this is.
Yeah, it really is. And so if you're affected in any way, please check the show notes. There's some really good links on there.
Yeah, this week there are. We've also included BEAT, which is the sort of national organisation. And Dave is an ambassador for BEAT. So please have a look at the show notes if you want any of those agencies.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's take a bit of a break here just to talk about our podcast recommendation for the week. Claire, what have you been listening to?
I cleared out my wardrobe on Tuesday. That's the kind of thing you end up doing when you're so your housebound with a chicken pox child. And so I listened to a few episodes of Malcolm Gladwell, Revisionist History. I've always been a big fan of his. I love his books, like The Tipping Point and that kind of thing. And his podcast is a look at the overlooked and misunderstood. So every episode re-examines something from the past. And I mean, a lot of them are very good, but I would particularly recommend, I think it's series 3, episode 6, which is called The Hug Heard Round the World, which is about Sammy Davis Jr. and the choices he made to fit into essentially a racist America and how unpopular those were with his like fellow black men and women. It just makes you realise how horrendous things were just so recently. And it's a very well put together story.
OK, I haven't listened to any of those, but I'll give that one a go. Okay, so kind of let's go back and just think about Dave's story again. Any other, you know, what struck you from the podcast overall?
Well, I was struck that when he was in the thick of it, he didn't see it as a problem. That came across as very surprising. In fact, he sort of quite enjoyed it at the beginning. And that made me feel pretty uncomfortable. But I think it was also very important to realise that there is always a benefit. And if you're going to support someone to change behaviour, there's like most people are finding something in that psychological illness, like, you know, that appeals to them, obviously. Otherwise, I suppose, I don't know whether they'd be doing it, although that's not the case with everything. I'm very aware of that. It's not the case with depression and stuff. But yeah, we sort of need to understand that behaviour to be able to kind of treat them sort of thing, I'm guessing.
Because he talked about kind of panorama, didn't he? And how everything that was portrayed was doom and gloom and didn't reflect how he was feeling about it at the time. And however misguided that is, it's useful to realise that that's where somebody's at.
Yeah, definitely. And so, obviously, overall, you know, he realised over time that like this was, you know, a horrific illness and, you know, he definitely needed treating. But yeah, I was just surprised by that beginning, like that beginning that there was, you know, there was so much that he was kind of getting a kick out of, weirdly.
Does feel uncomfortable, definitely.
Yeah, I did feel uncomfortable. And it, you know, God, it must have been so difficult for his family and everyone watching him go through it. And also, if I can jump straight in with the second point, it wasn't about vanity as such. Like it, and I don't think he saw it as a kind of, I'm overweight and like as such. He kind of, it was more like about freezing time, wasn't it, for him? And fitting in, not sticking out, and not growing up.
That not growing up thing was interesting, wasn't it?
Like it was kind of like, I think he said something like he wanted to freeze in amber sort of thing. And that really was like very kind of like clear to me why, you know, why he was doing it then. It was like a surprising reason. And I guess that's perhaps, you know, there are surprising women reasons within the men, you know, having anorexia. Perhaps they're different from what women are experiencing. Yeah, and it was interesting that he didn't go down that sort of typical kind of wanting to bulk up sort of masculine thing.
Yeah.
And I think that was very much sort of linked to his kind of indifference towards masculinity, wasn't
it? Yeah. yeah, I guess if kind of being, you know, if those very masculine images that we see on the front of Men's Health, if they kind of really have a hold on you, then you're going to aspire to that kind of shape, aren't you? So maybe yeah. that's why some young men kind of get into the, you know, the bulking up yeah. thing and so on. But Dave maybe wasn't as sort of susceptible to those images. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was one bit that didn't get into the podcast, I'm afraid, because we didn't have time to include it. But I'd really like to tell you about it because I thought it was very, very interesting. Dave, as we've mentioned, is an ambassador for BEAT. And one of the things that BEAT have done is this kind of cheat sheet. And the idea is that, you know, we all know that you've only got 10 minutes with your GP, and some GPs are really well informed about these things and some are not so well informed. So basically, if you're going to see them, you can download this cheat sheet from the BEAT website and you fill out the sections beforehand. So basically, when you go in, you can hand it to the doctor and get the most out of those, you know, crucial 10 minutes. So, you know, it might be like, what's going on, what outcomes you would like. I just thought that was such a...
Yeah, it's a really simple, amazing idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
No reason why you can't use that for anything else, actually.
Yeah, like, that's true.
You know,
yeah,
I'm sure it would be quite useful for, you know, all sorts of illnesses.
Yeah.
I actually saw someone post on Twitter yesterday about if it was okay to write down some stuff before they went to see the doctor. And it sounded like she might have had a sort of psychological illness. And lots of people have gone back with like, yeah, it's fine. And people have said that they can get into the doctors and decide to say that they're actually fine, like, or, you know, play down their kind of... illness, and so it helps them to sort of tell the brutal truth by just kind of passing over the piece of paper and going, look, is there
like, it's kind of like the opposite thing, you know, the stereotype that somebody goes and Twitters on about having a sore throat for 10 minutes and then just as they're leaving they say, yeah. Oh, by the way, I've got this massive lump. It's like yeah. actually let's try going in there and straight away saying what's yeah. wrong so that the doctor's got a bit of a fighting chance of helping you. Yeah. So next week we're going to be hearing something completely different. We'll be hearing from Naomi, who I'm not even going to try to classify. She's got so many strings to her bow, really fascinating areas in her life, and it was very hard to choose one of them to focus on.
That's a bit of a cop-out, isn't it?
Well,
can't we have a bit more of a clue than that?
No, absolutely, but here's a bit of a clip just to give you a taster.
And I remember asking, like, one of the drama teachers there, what, you know, in it back at the school, you know, what should I do? And he worked with a lot of Down syndrome people, and he was like, oh, do this, do that. So I went out with a whole plan, like a name game, you know, hello. So first of all, clap your hands and say your name. And then we got out there and it was like, we can't all clap our hands. We can't all stand up. We can't all say our name. We just have to rethink this completely.
We are The Backstory Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, at The Backstory Pod on Twitter. Tell your friends, strong arm your neighbours, sign up your granny, search for The Backstory with Claire and Susie in your trusted podcast directory, and hit subscribe. We'll be back next week. See you soon. Did you say bye first?
No, you say bye.
Oh, no, you say bye first.
You say bye.